Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Pedro Domingos. Pedro is a globally renowned, top-ranking data scientist and artificial intelligence researcher. Now, Pedro, you've produced so many outstanding research and innovation contributions with lasting, significant global impact. And we're really fortunate to have you come in and share so much of your expertise and your insights and wisdom with our audience.
Thanks for having me.
Now, we're going to start off with some of your most recent roles and research interests. You know, for example, recently you and your PhD student, Abe Friesen, contributed the paper winning the top prize in July at the 24th International Joint Conference on Artificial Intelligence, which is the world's largest AI conference. And of course, you have other achievements as well. So we're going to sort of go into this in a little bit more detail. Now, you and Abe developed a new algorithm often described as magical. Let's explore this work. Can you define optimization in the context of AI and the broad class of non-convex optimization problems?
Yes. So optimization is really what a lot of science, engineering, and business problems boil down to at the end of the day. Right, it's the problem of finding the settings for the variables that give you the most of what you want. Like, for example, in a factory, you might want to make the most, of some product subject to the machinery and the, components that you have and whatnot. Or, the universe is maximizing entropy subject to keeping energy constant. And, in AI, we often have optimization problems like, I'm a robot, I'm looking at 2D images, I want to reconstruct the 3D scene that's giving rise to those images, and the goal of the optimization there is to minimize the error with which I do that reconstruction. And, there's examples from this essentially all over. What our algorithm is doing is basically taking some ideas from AI and computer science and bringing them over to the problem of optimization with numeric variables. So you can do optimization with discrete variables, which is what people have traditionally done in AI, or you can do it with numeric variables, which is what happens in most of engineering, and also increasingly in AI.
Well, it's an amazing piece of work. Now, can you tell us what are the roots of RIDIS, the evolution of the research, and what is RIDIS?
Yeah, so RIDIS stands for recursive decomposition into independent subspaces. And the idea is really this notion of break. It's actually a very, I think, intuitive notion, which is when we human beings solve problems, what we always do, whether it's in daily life or as engineers or computer scientists, we break them up into smaller sub-problems, and then we break them up again until the problems that remain are simple enough that you can just solve them one at a time outright. And then you combine the solutions, back again into finally the solution to the whole problem. And as widespread as this is in computer science, the thing that's amazing is that in continuous problems, people don't do that. People actually solve extremely difficult problems, like, for example, this problem of, reconstructing a 3D scene, or another one is, figuring out how proteins fold. They have problems with a huge number of variables. The problems are extremely complex, but they don't use this kind of problem decomposition. So, they use these methods like gradient descent and simulated annealing, which, are only good up to a point. So the motivation behind RDIS was really to bring some of those ideas from AI and computer science over into continuous optimization.
Just fascinating. It kind of reminds me of my early programming days where we did something called stepwise refinement. So now, let's get to the magical part. What is the performance of RIDIS?
Yeah, the thing that's amazing about this, right, and that, that we're really, shocked by almost, is that when we do this, we often wind up getting exponential improvements either the speed with which we can solve the problem or the quality of the solution given a fixed time. So, for example, in this vision problem, the goal is to minimize, the error with which you predict, each pixel. And RDIS compared to, standard methods, it reduced the error by, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions, you know, tens of millions, which is something, you know, usually in these things you're happy if you reduce the error by 10%, but this is reducing the error by many orders of magnitude. And the reason this happens is that precisely because we're doing this decomposition of the problem into smaller subproblems, the individual problems are over a smaller number of variables, and as a result, there's an exponentially smaller space to search. So when you can do this, which is not always, when you can do this, you potentially get a really spectacular improvement.
You know, I'm just fascinated. You know, my mind is spinning now about the possibilities. Can you give us some examples, like really specific examples where it could be applied and what this means to each domain of the application?
Yeah, so in principle, this can be applied to any domain where, continuous optimization is applied. And, you know, the number of domains where that happens is really endless. I mentioned two, vision is one. Another one is robotics, right? You want to plan the motion of your robot, of the, you know, the navigation through, you know, space or, you know, how the manipulator, how the hand moves. This is another problem to which you can apply this. Protein folding, as I mentioned, is a problem of figuring out from the sequence of amino acids of a protein how it's going to fold into a 3D shape, which is what controls its properties. So for example, if we can do this well, it's an extremely difficult problem, but if you can do it well, you can actually design labs, drugs. Instead of in the lab, you can do it by computer. And so that would really, you know, speed up the progress in a lot of things. And then, you know, then there's applications, you know, in things like business, like, for example, deciding, you know, for example, what is the best use to put your resources to, or how much of different things to produce. There's applications in engineering, like, for example, designing the shape of an airplane is a continuous optimization problem, right? How do you make it so it flies, as efficiently as possible while burning the smallest possible amount of energy? Make it aerodynamic, same thing for cars, also designing things like electronic circuits, designing, you know, power plants, figuring out what is the best configuration of components to do different things and so on.
You know, that's interesting. So I can see now also applications in economics and finance, epidemiology, genomics and so on. Do you see applications in those areas?
Yeah, definitely. So, in economics, right, there's, there are all these variables that you need to vary to get your best results. You know, here's a very, you know, classic example, right, is finance, right? You want to, for example, find the optimal sequence of trades that will, maximize, let's say your profit, like the amount of money that you make at the end of the day, right? You have a portfolio that has a certain percentage of different things like bonds, stocks of different kinds, and what you want to know is what, you know, fractions of different things to have in that portfolio over time. Well, that's another continuous optimization problem, and so on. Like, for example, epidemiology, you might want to optimize, one of the big things in epidemiology is to detect outbreaks early, right? But you can't have sensors everywhere because that's not feasible. So you might want to try to optimize where exactly you put them such that the cost is minimal, but also you get the earliest detection possible. So, yeah, there's applications in all of these areas.
Gee, Petro, I see a Nobel Prize in your future. Now, how do you see the work evolving, and what are your specific next steps?
Right. So one of the things that we want to do, of course, is explore more applications of this new algorithm, right? We're still finding out what it's good for and what it's not. But the other thing that we want to do is improve the algorithm, right? I think, you know, part of why we won this award is that this is not necessarily just one algorithm. It's potentially a whole new direction in optimization. And, you know, whole new directions in optimization don't come up, you know, every day. There's these approaches based on, you know, basically gradient descent, which is just, you know, going up the hill, trying to find the peak. When simulated annealing came along, it's basically adding noise to try and jump over, you know, the local optimum. This was a huge revolution. And so if things pan out, and we don't know if they will, this could be a whole new direction in optimization. So there's a lot to do. One of the things that we want to do is come up with better methods for figuring out how to break the problem into subproblems, right? This all depends on that. If you find a good way to break the problem into subproblems, you're in good shape. Otherwise, this might not give you that much of a benefit. And we've only really scratched the surface in doing that. And another example of something that we want to do is, right now, we are only dealing with the problem in the variables that it's, you know, originally described in, like, for example, the positions of the different amino acids in the protein. But I think that you can probably solve problems a lot better if you transform those variables into a new set of variables. Like, you know, people in machine learning do things like principal components analysis to find the main directions of variation. And I have a feeling that if you combine ideas like that with this algorithm, you will find much better ways to split the problem in terms of these derived variables, and as a result, do much better. So yeah, so there's a lot of exciting directions to pursue.
You know, there's a lot of interdisciplinary thought in this. So are you interfacing with many of the other departments within your university?
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, one of the fascinating things about optimization, right, is that it cuts across so many disciplines. And in fact, you know, I've been talking not only with people in AI and computer science about this, but, you know, with people in math, in EE, in statistics. You know, I've talked with people in biology, right, people who work, you know, basically full-time on this problem of protein folding and then, you know, and using the results for drug design and so on. So, yeah, definitely.
Now, you talked about maybe there's areas that maybe it's not so good at. So can you talk about some of its limitations?
Yeah, so I mean, you know, this algorithm is definitely not a, you know, not a silver bullet. It's not going to solve every problem. It's a very good problem it's a very good solution when the problem has this characteristic that it can be divided into smaller subproblems. And what does that mean? It means that the variables don't all interact equally with each other. There's like these clumps of variables that interact strongly with each other, but then the interactions across the clumps are weaker. When that happens, this potentially gives you an exponential speed up. When that doesn't happen, you know, basically the algorithm just winds up maybe not breaking things up and defaulting to standard techniques like gradient descent. And again, you know, we have some very nice theoretical results proving that if problems have certain characteristics, then we get these exponential speed ups, but, you know, but there's a lot more research to do there as well.
Well, that's really exciting. I could see all the different domains in the audience there sort of following your work. Now, Pedro, you also have other achievements. For example, you had the KDD 2015 Test the Time Award. You're publishing a new book, The Master Algorithm, and winning the KDD 2014 Innovation Award. So let's kind of drill into these in a little bit more detail. What led to the winning of the Test of Time Award?
Yeah, so this was a paper that we wrote 15 years ago that was one of the first papers to do what's now called data stream mining. And the idea in data stream mining is that these days what you have is not a database that you go and do a data mining project on and, you know, 6 months later you deliver the results and the customer uses them. These days what, you know, almost every organization has is a continuous stream of data that is coming to them, you know, day by day, second by second. You know, think of Google with searches or you know, or an investment bank with, you know, with stocks, right? There's never, the information never stops. It's essentially infinite. And so now the goal is that your learning is no longer one shot, right? What you want to do is you want to do machine learning as the data comes in. You're always using it to refine your model of the phenomena that you're interested in. And at the same time that you're using the data to learn the model, you also have to be using the results to make decisions. So you may be trying to understand, you know, how the stock market behaves, but you're also generating buy and sell orders on the fly. And this is a very different problem. So for example, you have, you know, the data may be infinite, but your computers only have finite memory. So you have to be able to do this while staying within a fixed amount of memory. You also have to be able to do it in a fixed amount of time per new sample that you get. Otherwise, it quickly becomes unmanageable. And so what we did in that paper was one of the first algorithms in the case of that paper, and then we had a whole series of papers doing this to other algorithms. We took one of the classic machine learning algorithms, which is decision tree induction, and we produced an online, you know, data stream version of that algorithm that had this property of learning the model as it went along. And we were also able to prove, and I think this was a lot of part of why the work had a lot of impact, that we could guarantee that that our algorithm learned a model that was statistically indistinguishable from the model that it would have learned if it was applied in batch mode to the whole infinite data set, you know, into the future with infinite resources. And, you know, so now, like these days, everybody's doing data stream mining. At the time, you know, it was kind of like a very speculative idea, but, you know, but it's really happened now, which I think is why we got this Test of Time award.
So what made you even get into this area of research and thinking that you could even produce these kind of results?
You mean in general in machine learning or this particular algorithm and data stream mining?
Actually, both.
Well, sure. So what got me, and, you know, like the reason I do machine learning is that, you know, the impact that you can have with machine learning is amazing. You know, you could work on, say, you know, robotics and, you know, maybe produce, you know, better robots or house robots. That's great. You could work on, you know, protein folding and you know, produce better drugs. You could work on a lot of these different things that people in research, you know, work on. But the thing about machine learning is that if you come up with a new, better machine learning algorithm, you will potentially have impact not just in one of these areas, but, you know, across a large number of them. So, you know, in terms of bang for the buck for your research, I think, you know, machine learning is hard to beat. And the other thing is that it's a lot of fun, right? You get to play in everybody's backyard. Today you collaborate with biologists. You know, tomorrow you collaborate with, you know, with economists. Tomorrow it's with, you know, web engineers, and so, you know, you never have a dull moment. So that's, you know, that's my general motivation for doing machine learning. The data stream stuff, you know, the reason we came up with it was, you know, I did a lot of work at the time, and I still do a lot of it, on scaling up machine learning to larger data sets, right? This was, you know, the circa, you know, 2000. This was when things were really exploding in terms of the internet and data sizes. And the challenge for a lot of us was to take our machine learning algorithms, like decision tree induction, that were very nice, but they only worked on maybe a few hundred or a few thousand examples. And we needed to scale them up to, you know, millions and, you know, these days billions. And the question was how to do that. And there was a succession of, you know, algorithms, you know, progressively scaling up, for example, decision tree induction to larger and larger things. And what I started thinking was, well, you know, let's take a step back and see where this is going to lead. What is the limit? And then I thought, well, the limit is not that you have millions of examples or billions, is that if you have infinite, right? If we know how to handle an infinite number of examples, then we're good. And so, you know, this algorithm called VFDT for very fast decision trees, you know, came out of that way of thinking.
Just fascinating work. Now, how about the KDD Innovation Award? What contributed to this outstanding honor?
Yeah, so the KDD Innovation Award is not really an award for one particular piece of work. It's sort of like an award, you know, it's a bit like the Nobel Prize, right? It's like it's an award for some outstanding, you know, body of work, you know, that you have done over time. You know, it could be just one, you know, thing that you did that had a lot of impact, but more often it's for a series of things. And so, you know, so in a way that award is a recognition for all the different things that I've worked on over time. You know, some of which we've touched on. So, you know, the data stream mining was one of them. You know, another one was you know, this work that I've done that also has had a lot of impact on, you know, how to do data mining for word of mouth marketing, you know, for marketing in social networks, for maximizing your influence in a social network. I also did, you know, a lot of other work on, for example, applying machine learning to information integration. But you have a lot of different databases that came from different origins. You need to turn them on to something coherent. How do you do that? Our idea was to use learning to do that, where at the time people were just using things like trying to match the names of the fields and things like that. You know, I've also done a lot of other work on scaling things up, as I mentioned, you know, besides, you know, this paper that won the award. You know, and more recently I've worked on things like, you know, unifying logic and probability so we can have models that can both handle a lot of uncertainty and complexity and, you know, and so on.
So it sounds like you're a prime candidate for the AM Turing Award as well.
That's right. Right after the Nobel Prize.
Yeah, exactly. Let's shoot for the ball, right?
Yeah.
Now, you come out with this remarkable book. There's a lot of buzz about it because you've got some really interesting ideas in there. Can you talk about your new book and some of the key points in it that the audience needs to pay attention to?
Yeah, sure. So the book is called The Master Algorithm, How the Quest for the Ultimate Learning Machine Will Remake Our World. And it's basically a popular science book about machine learning. So it's not, you know, it's not a technical book. There's no equations. There's no, well, there's only a couple. There's no equations. There's no pseudocode. It's really trying to explain the deep ideas behind machine learning to a general, you know, book reading audience. In a way, it's trying to do for machine learning what, for example, the selfish gene did for, you know, evolutionary game theory, or chaos did for complexity theory, or, you know, like the elegant universe did for string theory. And you know, the reason I decided to write this book is that I realized there's a really urgent need for one, because machine learning is not, you know, a small, obscure field anymore that only, you know, a few scientists worry about. It's something that touches everybody's life every day. Everything you do online, you know, most people don't know this, but it's, you know, whether it's the Google searches that they get or Amazon recommendations or the choice of updates that, you know, Facebook shows them or tweets or Netflix movies, all these things are the result of machine learning. And a lot of people, you know, or even, you know, like these days, job applications get evaluated by learning algorithms. You know, there's these sites that will find dates for you using machine learning algorithms. So I think everybody, and there's a lot of decisions that you make both, you know, in your personal life and as a professional that depend on a lot of this machine learning. And there's a lot of issues like, you know, like privacy and the future of work and whatnot that we all need to make decisions about. And I think we want that discussion to be more informed by what machine learning is. Unfortunately, I think so far we, the machine learning experts, have not done a great job of, you know, letting people know what it's about. So when you hear machine learning in the media, and it, you know, it's basically every day, you know, whether it's Watson or Google's CAT network or, you know, the latest, you know, shenanigans with the NSA or whatever, the machine learning takes part in that story, but it's always this mysterious black box. Data goes in and, you know, amazing predictions come out. And, you know, so my goal was to, you know, demystify machine learning and give people, you know, a conceptual model of how learning works. And the other thing is that, you know, it's a very, you know, fascinating subject because both of its history, the ups and downs and the different, you know, tribes within the field. You know, there's the symbolists, there's the connectionists, you know, with deep learning, which is very popular these days. There's Bayesians and Bayesian learning. There's the people who do evolutionary algorithms. There's people who reason by analogy. And all of these different things have roots in different fields like neuroscience, evolutionary biology, you know, psychology, statistics. So, you know, I thought you could write a really, interesting book about this. And so, well, I decided to do it rashly perhaps, but, you know, it's there it is now.
Well, that's amazing. So we know now that's going to be a bestseller. Everybody's going to read this book. Everybody has to read this book because, it, as you indicated, it impacts every part of our lives, even from, you know, credit card to fraud detection, right? And this email spam, you name it, it's there everywhere. So.
Oh, yeah. I mean, actually, credit card is a good example. In fact, a bank these days uses machine learning basically at every step of what it does. It uses it to choose who to send offers to. It uses it to evaluate the offers. And then it uses, as you said, for fraud detection, right? When you get those messages saying, oh, strange use of your credit card, that was a machine learning algorithm. It uses it, you know, in its investments, right, you know, to trade things. It uses it, you know, to decide which customers maybe are about to leave so it can make them a better offer, you know, also known as churn prediction. So, yeah, this is just one example, right? You know, in finance, you're using machine learning every step of the way.
Again, the audience, they have to read this book. That's it. That's a command. Now, you've got your finger on the pulse in so many different areas, and you're like a legend, an icon. As I was mentioning, I was talking to a Google executive, and they're talking about how your seminal papers are sort of like iconic within that organization. So what will computers and robots look like by 2020? Because you're at the heart of everything.
Yeah, I mean, naturally, in a way, that's a great question, right? So in a way, my job as a researcher is to try to picture what they will look like 10 or 20 years from now and then help to bring it about, right? You know, like Alan Kay said, the best way to predict the future is to invent it. And really, the way you succeed, I think, in research and in some ways in anything else is by helping the inevitable happen. And of course, then you could be wrong, but that's what research is all about. So, you know, I think one of the things that's going to happen in the next, 10, 20 years is that we're going to see robots take off in a way that they haven't yet, right? So there's a lot of robots in factories, and then there's very simple ones like the Roomba, right, that vacuum floors. But I think we're reaching the point where, you know, robotics can really take off because the computing power is there, because the sensors are there, and, you know, the components are, you know, inexpensive enough that this actually becomes feasible. And also AI, right, which at the end of the day is the crucial question, is building the brain of the robot, has progressed to the point where we can actually start doing these things. But I think a lot of the robots that we're going to see are going to be very different from what people imagine. Like, people, when they think of a robot, they think of a robot like looks like a human, you know, like Terminator or the robot in Ex Machina, right? This is what people always think of. And, you know, there will be some robots like that because, for example, if you want a home robot, homes are designed for human beings, and so a robot in the shape of a human being probably, you know, will function very well there. But those are going to be, you know, 1% of all the robots. Most of them are going to have shapes that, you know, they're going to come in all sorts of shapes that you can't even imagine. Some of them, of course, are, you know, like a self-driving car is a robot, right? So it's just a robot in the shape of a car. But many other robots are going to be very specifically designed for the particular thing that they do in the world. And so there's going to be, if you will, I think, a Cambrian explosion of different kinds, you know, shapes and sizes and types of robots, and it's going to be very exciting. And, you know, and same with computers, right? I think we're going to see both increasingly powerful computers on the one end, you know, like server farms will get ever more powerful. They also have to get a lot more energy efficient because I think ultimately that's going to be the limit. But at the other end of the spectrum, we're also going to see tinier and tinier computers embedded in everything until it's like, you know, the world that we live in is going to have it's going to have computing embedded in it. You know, there's sort of like intelligence in all of the things that you deal with in your daily life. And it all works like this, you know, kind of great symphony whose purpose at the end of the day is to make the world, you know, better for us.
You know, that's kind of fascinating. You know, I was in July, I was asked to actually speak before the United Nations at their General Assembly. And in fact, I did something called Intervention, six of them, where you take the floor and speak. And one of the things that other speakers mentioned, and I also talked about as well, is that, you know, let's say 15 years ago when the Millennium Development Goals came out, maybe there was one small little passage about technology. And then subsequent since then, look what's happened, you know, the integration of broadband, the internet, mobile computing, smartphones, artificial intelligence, machine learning, just sort of the explosion of everything that's out there, none of which they anticipated. Like, it was zero anticipation, right? And if you look at the system, sustainable development goals, which will be ratified this year, going out to 2030, technology is underpinning much of it. And one of the questions I asked the group there at the General Assembly was, I said, but at all the discussions, I don't see you talking about artificial intelligence and robots and machine learning and the impact it's going to have or deep learning. And from what you're saying, it could be a major disruptive pivotal point in our history.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, this gets back to when you asked me, you know, why do you work on machine learning, is that if you care about all these, you know, global problems, machine learning and these kinds of technologies are going to be a big part of solving them. And, you know, in a way, you know, we're limited by our ingenuity, but I think we have so many tools at our disposal today that it behooves us to use them, you know, to solve all these problems. And I think we are going to see a lot of progress on them in the next 10, 20 years. And of course, not all of it is going to come from technology, but I think technology is a big part of it.
Yeah, and of course, the public's going to be now adept at this because they've just read your book, The Master Algorithm.
That's my hope, yeah.
Now, can you talk further about recent advances in knowledge discovery and data mining?
Yeah, so, you know, knowledge, discovering data mining, it didn't exist as a field, or barely existed 20 years ago. But now it's this huge, sprawling, field that reaches everywhere. And, even me, whom, you could say, I'm an old timer, I can't really keep up with everything that goes there, that goes on there anymore. But I can tell you what some of the main things are, right? And one of the main things is that, so data streams are still one of the, have become one of the big things that people do, right? So mining data continuously. Another one is, another very big one, which again, basically did not exist 20 years ago, is mining networks, is learning about networks. Often social networks, but it could also be other kinds of networks. Back when we did the work on word of mouth marketing, there was no Facebook and there was no Twitter and none of these things existed. These days, these social networks are, in a way, one of the centers of many people's lives. And there's both, amazing questions about how to best design these systems, right? Because in a way, it's a society that spans the globe, but that works by different rules than the society, in a village. So like the global village is, it's sort of like a much larger society playing by different rules. And we want to understand how people work in that setting, and also how to best design, if you're Facebook or your Twitter, you want to understand how to best design your systems, to make, as useful as possible for everybody and so on. So there's an enormous amount of research going on in that direction. And more generally, so what distinguishes the network from the types of things that people used to do, knowledge discovery on before is that when, you talk about credit, applications, right? What you usually do for things like that is you have a database of records of people. And from, you have like your credit history, how long you've been at your current residence, how long you've held your current job. And from there, you try to predict how good a credit risk the person is. And you make a separate prediction for each individual. You treat the world as being a bunch of isolated individuals. This makes the math much easier, but it's an extremely artificial assumption. And what network modeling does is say, no, all these people interact. They're nodes in the network. And now let's try to model how the whole network works. Not just people's own properties, but how they influence each other, the channels by which they communicate, and so on. And, this is a whole different world of things that we can do research on, and it's probably the single biggest area within knowledge discovery and data mining right now. Another area, of course, is that, the world is full of unstructured data. We used to only mine databases, literally databases of records, but these days we mine text, we mine video. Increasingly, we mine combinations of them, right? You have video and you have audio, and then you have also text about it, and you're trying to extract knowledge from all these things at the same time. So yeah, there's a lot of exciting stuff happening, and there's going to be a lot of progress in the next decade.
It's interesting. You talk about sort of this idea of network modeling, and it kind of reminds me of social learning. Some people say that what separates us from primate, other kinds of primates or Neanderthal or Denisovans is that, we have this sort of critical mass of people who speak and communicate and share knowledge, and that creates a social learning. And in essence, it improves our ability to evolve and to do disruptive innovation. And so perhaps because China now has, 1.3 billion people and they, in essence, share some similar culture, similar language, maybe that's going to create some kind of upswing in innovation just in that area because of this idea of social learning, because the mass of people, the network and the twining of all of those people working together, and also with this basis of focus on education and discovery, maybe that will create something that we haven't seen before as more and more, there's this proliferation of the internet in China. Anyways, we're just sort of brainstorming here.
Yeah, so... So I agree, and notice the following, right? What gives us this great advantage over other animals is the fact that we're social, right? And then we learn, from others. But we used to learn from 100 others, and these days we learn from 7 billion others. So, just picture how much faster the progress can be when you have a 7 billion wide social network, learning to do things better, as opposed to a network of, basically only the members of your tribe. So, yeah, it's pretty exciting.
Yeah, really exciting. And again, at the heart of this is your work in the master algorithm.
That's right. At the end of the day, so this, I didn't mention this before, right? But the master algorithm is this idea that there's an algorithm, that one algorithm can learn all the knowledge that is to learn by applying it to the appropriate data. And if that algorithm exists, right, it's a hypothesis, which I can't prove, but I believe it does exist, then, you know, first of all, our job as machine learning researchers is to discover it. But second of all, imagine what that algorithm can do once you unleash it on all the data that all the people in the world produce.
You know, it's an interesting idea. Have you ever talked to Tom Mitchell at Carnegie and his never-ending language learner? It seems like it's the roots of this sort of master algorithm.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I know Tom very well. In fact, you know, I spent a semester at CMU a few years ago at his invitation teaching a course on some of the stuff that I've been doing. And exactly, I would describe NEL, right, which is short for never-ending language learner, as Tom Mitchell's approach to the master algorithm, right? As opposed, and it's also sort of like a stream mining algorithm, right? As opposed to something that does one-shot learning of one thing one day and then it's done, it's something that you turn on and it continues to learn forever, and hopefully it gets better and better. And, you know, I mentioned there were five schools of thought in machine learning, and one of them is symbolists, and, you know, Tom Mitchell is very much, you know, one of the leaders of the symbolist school of thought, where you try to learn using symbolic representations. And in his case, right, what his algorithm does is it reads the web, it reads a lot of text, and then it forms, a formal representation of what it learned inside the computer that it can then use to reason and answer questions.
You know, you just mentioned this one area of machine learning, and we talked about others. Can you go into the other four areas in a little bit more detail?
Yeah, so the idea of the symbolist, right, is that it's based on, you know, it comes from Newell and Simon's physical symbol system hypothesis, which is the idea of abstraction, right? I don't care what the substrate of my computation is. Computing, and in particular learning, can happen just by manipulating symbols in the same way that mathematicians and logicians manipulate symbols when they make deductions and when they make proofs. So this is one school of thought. Another, very prominent one is the connectionists. Connectionists are people whose approach to machine learning is to reverse engineer the brain. They say, look, you know, the best learning algorithm is the one inside your skull, so, you know, let's see what goes on in there and see if we can reproduce it on a computer. So then you build a model of a neuron, and then you connect those models into a neural network, and then you try to make it learn in a similar way to what the brain learns, which is by strengthening the connections between neurons that fire at the same time, also known as Hebb's rule. Then there's the evolutionaries, and those are the people who say, actually, no, the best learning algorithm in the world is not your brain, it's evolution. Because evolution produced your brain and the rest of you as well, and all other living creatures, so it's pretty amazing. And we have a good sense of how evolution works, right, with genes and with natural selection. So let's try to simulate that on a computer, except we're going to direct evolution to produce the things that we want as opposed to just letting it happen randomly. Then there's the Bayesians. This is a school of thought that comes from statistics, right? It has a long history in statistics. The Bayesians take their name from Bayes' theorem. And Bayes' theorem is basically a way to incorporate new information into your beliefs. The key problem for Bayesians is uncertainty, is that your knowledge is uncertain, and you need ways to reason with that uncertainty, and the way to do that is with probability. So you start out with your hypothesis, you have your prior beliefs in them, which is the probability that each one is true before you see evidence, and then as you see data, you update your beliefs. Some of the hypotheses become more probable, some of them become less probable, and that's how you acquire knowledge. And finally, there's the analogizers, which is a looser grouping of people who do learning based on the notion of similarity, of doing an analogy between situations that you already know and the situations that you would like to understand. Like, for example, you know, Bohr came up with quantum mechanics, or the first version of quantum mechanics, by doing an analogy between the atom and the solar system, right, where the nucleus was the sun and the electrons were the planets. And, you know, there's, you know, one famous algorithm of this school is support vector machines, right? Support vector machines, the support vectors are basically these examples that you remember, and then you classify new examples by comparing them with the support vectors, and if, you know, the closer support vectors, you know, have more of a vote and so forth. So yeah, so those, and you know, then there's more ideas, but I guess these are the five main ones, and you know, and in the book I have one chapter about each one of them.
That's amazing. Again, just referencing the book. Now, can you overview your work with the International Machine Learning Society?
Yeah, so the main job of the International Machine Learning Society is to organize the International Conference on Machine Learning, which is the top or one of the two top conferences on machine learning in the world. So what we do is, you know, we select sites for the conference. So we invite, you know, candidacies, select sites. We also select or find general chairs for the conference. The general chair is sort of like the person who's in charge of the conference as a whole. And program chairs, who are the people who will then recruit the program committee and then, you know, eventually review the papers and, you know, choose which papers are going to be in the conference and choose invited speakers and so forth.
You know, have you ever had people like Jeffrey Hinton and Jan LeCun and Joshua Bengio at these things?
Oh, yeah. So those three people that you mentioned, they are like probably the three most prominent connectionists. The main connectionist conference is another conference called NIPS, Neural Information Processing Systems, right? And again, the history goes back to these, you know, different tribes of machine learning. ICML sort of like has its roots in the symbolist school of machine learning, which is more connected to classic, you know, symbolic AI. NIPS has more of its roots in the, you know, in sort of like the whole neural network movement that took off in the 80s. And, you know, they all publish papers in ICML and NIPS, but for them, sort of like the main conference is NIPS. The good news is that, you know, like, 20 years ago when I started going to this conference, there were very few people that actually went to both. And these days, a lot of people go to both ICML and NIPS, so there's actually a very good interface between the two communities.
Oh, that's excellent. Now, some, you know, broader questions. What are the big questions in machine learning?
Well, so one of the big questions is this question that we were just talking about of, you know, is there such a thing as a universal learner, right? So again, there's different views on this. Some people say there is no such thing as a learner that can learn all knowledge just giving the right data. You need to come up with a different learner for each problem, and that's what you have to do. I think actually at the end of the day, both of these people are right. So there is a master algorithm, but the master algorithm it doesn't solve the whole problem, right? It solves 80% of the problem, and then the other 20%, there will be room for, you know, for all sorts of different variations. And now, if there is such an algorithm, then the next question is, you know, what is it going to look like? You know, people in these different schools of thought in machine learning, they have different problems that they're interested in and that they work on. As I mentioned, Bayesians worry very much about the problem of uncertainty. How do you deal with the fact that the problem is uncertain? You know, for connectionists, one of the questions is, you know, how well can you, or how well do you need to mimic the brain in order to get good results? And then there's this question, which is very big these days and is behind deep learning, which is the brain is a neural network with many layers. But, you know, in the past, people only knew how to train models with maybe one layer besides the input and output layers, one so-called hidden layer. And really, but that's, you know, that's not going to get you a brain. And where a lot of progress has been is in learning models with many layers, that inside those representations, you develop your own representation of the world as opposed to it being fed to you by features that, you know, the machine learning, the data scientist concocted to give to the algorithm. So that's the type of questions school of thought worries about, and so there's similar questions in all the schools. But I think that at the end of the day, and you know, this is very much the argument that I make in the book, and then that I make to the community, is that each of these tribes, if you will, is solving a real problem, right? And they have some very brilliant solutions to them. But in the end, to solve the machine learning problem, it's not enough to solve one of these problems. You have to solve all of them in the same algorithm. As long as, you know, if you deal with uncertainty, but you don't know how to deal with a complex world with, you know, symbols and relations and classes and whatnot, then you're not going to solve the problem. So the biggest question for me is, how do we combine these pieces into what you might call a grand unified theory of machine learning? In the same way that, you know, there's grand unified theories in physics, you know, like the standard model, or in biology, like the central dogma, I think, you know, we should be looking for one in machine learning and in AI.
And I guess Pedro, you're going to do that.
Well, actually, I would love to do that, right? But part of the reason why I wrote this book is that I think my chances as an individual or, you know, my group of doing that are very small. And I think also we need, so number one, we need more people in the field. And second of all, we need new ideas. I think part of the problem is also that as clever as the ideas are that people in these different, areas have come up with already, my feeling is that there are some really crucial ideas that are still missing. And so I would like to see new people come into the field with a fresh mind, maybe from other areas or people who are just students and who will think of things that we haven't thought of. And my guess is that it's going to take one of those people to discover, you know, this universal learner.
I'm just thinking, have you ever looked at the work of Judea Pearl, especially his last piece of work, you know, where he's created sort of this mathematical model for causal relationships or causation?
Yeah, so, you know, Huda Pearl is, you know, a shining example of an AI researcher, and in fact, he's probably the most prominent of the Bayesians, right? So in the Bayesian school of thought, Huda Pearl, so he created and developed Bayesian networks and, you know, algorithms for them, and this caused a revolution in AI, and I think a lot of, you know, the growth in the Bayesian school came from him. A lot of his interest and a lot of interest of the people who work on Bayesian networks is in understanding causality, right? It's, discovering correlations is all nice, but what we really want at the end of the day is to understand causal relationships. So after he did his work on Bayesian networks, he kind of went on to use it and to develop it to understand causality, and so he has his own, theory of causality that he's still working on.
Now, let's expand this idea of big questions in machine learning to what are the big questions in artificial intelligence overall?
Yeah, so, you know, in artificial intelligence, really the problem at the end of the day boils down to the following thing, is that on the one hand, we need powerful representations that we can encode if we want to build, you know, a real intelligence as opposed to just, you know, a system that does a very specialized thing. We need very powerful representations. At the same time, when a representation is powerful, it also becomes intractable. Computing with it, you know, doing inference with it becomes unbearably expensive. So AI really boils down to this problem of how do you find representations that are expressive enough for what you want to do with them, like, you know, controlling a robot or whatever, or, you know, building a knowledge base on the web. But at the same time, they're not so expressive that they've become intractable. And people have come at this problem in all sorts of different ways, And progress is still ongoing, but that I think is really the crux of the matter. There was a very big sea change in AI in the last 20 years, whereas, you know, in the 70s, and early 80s, people just tried to design representations and then design algorithms to reason with them. There was no learning. The big change of the last 20, 30 years is that now what is at the center of AI is machine learning. And part of the reason is that it takes advantage of all the data that's available. So, you know, instead of having to program things, you can actually have the programs learn for themselves. But I think the other is that with machine learning, you also find a new approach to this trade-off between expressiveness and tractability, which is, the learning that's part of the job, right? I don't have to, you know, build the knowledge base of all the knowledge in the world anymore with all the infinite details that entails. And I don't have to find very complicated ways of reasoning about it because the machine learning and the ability to reason uncertain, you know, to do uncertain reasoning with things like Bayesian networks will do a lot of the work for you.
So again, just maybe another sort of tractor, and we, you know, just sort of covered many of these elements already, but what do you see as the big questions in data science?
Well, data science, so... I guess the first question, data science, is what is it exactly, right? Data science is a very new term, but it's become a very popular one. My view is that data science is actually something that encompasses both machine learning and statistics and high performance and distributed computing and human-computer interaction. So I think data science is really the combination of all the different things that it takes to make the to extract knowledge from data, right? So it's very interesting because it's a very broad field that touches on many different things, all the way from the hardware to the human who's trying to understand what the learning algorithm is doing. And so, you know, in each of these areas, you have very important problems. And, you know, one of them, for example, is that a lot of people are working on is, in order to be able to learn models on very large data sets, you know, just working on a single processor isn't enough anymore, right? So I need a whole server farm, or I need, you know, large numbers of multi-core processors. And now I have the problem of, like, how do I do learning on those architectures, right? It's not just the von Neumann architecture anymore. The problem becomes a lot more interesting. At the other end of the spectrum, there's the human-computer interaction side, right? A lot of the you know, criticism that a lot of people have of a lot of machine learning models, like, for example, deep networks, is that they're very impenetrable, right? It's this big pile of parameters, and you don't understand how it works. And maybe one day this was okay, but now that a lot of organizations have mission-critical applications, you know, being run by these learning algorithms, it's very important to be able to understand what the algorithm is doing and to interact with it, to tell it, no, this part is wrong, you know, please do that, or here's what I would like to happen. And then in the middle, of course, there's all the machine learning problems that we've already talked about. So data science is a very broad area with a lot of very exciting problems.
What are the big questions in scaling learning algorithms to big data?
Yeah, so, you know, one of them I just alluded to, right, it's how to parallelize learning algorithms. How to take, for example, you know, we started out talking about optimization algorithms. At the end of the day, a machine learning algorithm boils down to optimization because you're trying to find the best parameters or the best, you know, choices, you know, at the nodes of your decision tree or whatever that best fit the data, right? And so you need to solve these optimization problems on a very large scale. And one of the ways to do that is to parallelize. So parallel and distributed machine learning is one frontier. The other one is how to learn on data streams, right? So this is this work that we've also already talked about. You know, another one, precisely because now we're dealing with networks as opposed to isolated examples, is, and this creates a very, you know, a huge scaling problem, right? Because now you're no longer dealing with just descriptions of individuals, but with, you know, think of Facebook, right? Facebook is actually a network that that's almost all of humanity, you know, or it's of the order of all of humanity. It's like, you know, 2 billion people or whatever it is these days. So all of these things create, on the one hand, enormous opportunities, but on the other hand, you know, very, very tough problems in terms of scaling up. A more subtle problem in scaling up that people don't often think when they think of scaling up is that at the end of the day, scaling up is not just taking your old algorithms and making them run faster, although, you know, there's a lot of great work to be done in there, and in some ways that's where the lowest hanging fruit are. I think at the end of the day, the most interesting scaling up problem is what algorithms can we design for this world of large-scale data that are actually different from the ones that we had before? In many cases, the algorithms that we had before, they asymptote. They can only take advantage of so much data. Even algorithms that apparently can learn from unlimited amounts of data like decision tree learners, because of the greedy search process, often they have a lot of trouble discovering what is in the data. So I think we really need to do a lot of deep thinking in machine learning about, now that we're in this world of big data, what, you know, what are the new kinds of learning that we can design?
And then what are the major questions in maximizing word of mouth in social networks?
Yeah, so this, as I mentioned, you know, starting with our paper, has now become a very, you know, active area of research, right? So there's people working on many different aspects of this problem. When we started out, we started out just by modeling one network with one type of relation among people. Let's say, you know, you have friendship. And the network was also static. You just made this decision a priori of who to try to influence. And now, you know, the frontier, right, is, well, what happens when, you know, in the real world, right, there's many different relations. There's like, you know, people can be friends, they can be coworkers, you know, you can be my boss, or I can be, you know, your customer, right? And all of these different relationships interact. Also, there's many different kinds of agents in society, right? We started out just having one kind, but again, you know, there's companies, there's governments, there's people, there's different groups of people, right? There's the members of ACM, there's the members of IEEE, there's, you know, there's other engineers, there's et cetera, right? How do you work in this very rich world? And then things happen over time, right? In reality, the way you work in a social network is you do something now, you see what its results are, and then you do something as a result of what happened, and so on and so forth. So dealing with network data over time is another big problem. Another big direction is identifying the network, right? All of this will not work well if you don't know what the network is. So how do you figure out who is linked to whom and how? And, you know, often what you have is indirect results of people's connections. You don't see the connections directly. So another big problem is how can you infer people's connections from the behavior of the network and so on.
And then what are the big questions in unifying logic and probability?
Yeah, so this is actually one of the areas that I've worked most intensively in, and it's, I think, one of the key parts of coming up with this master algorithm. It has to do with this issue that we talked about earlier of the trade-off between expressiveness and tractability, right? Traditionally, in AI, people use, you know, first-order logic as a representation because, you know, it encompasses just about anything that you might want to say or program. But, you know, you can deal with objects, with relations among them, with networks, like we were just talking about. But at the same time, right, there's the issue of uncertainty, you know, which people like Huda Perl did a lot of work on. You want these representations like Bayesian networks or more general graphical models that can handle the uncertainty and the noise and the ambiguity and the incomplete information of the real world. So in order to really solve AI and in order to have a master, you know, learning algorithm, you need a representation that combines both logic and probability. And this at first sight seems like an incredibly hard problem, right? So, you know, people in philosophy and math and logic have worked on this problem for 200 years or more even. And, you know, and progress was very slow. And some people, you know, even argue that it's impossible to unify logic and probability because they're fundamentally incompatible, which would be very bad news for AI and machine learning if it was true. The good news is that these days we've actually, you know, in the last decade, we've made, you know, spectacular progress on this problem. And in fact, I would even say that at this point, we have mostly figured out how we can unify logic and probability in a single representation. For example, there's what are called Markov logic networks, which is in essence, your model is a set of logical formulas, as in a knowledge base, but the formulas have weights. So if you strongly believe in a formula, it has a higher weight. If maybe it's an uncertain belief, it has a lower weight. And then the probability of the state of the world goes up with the number of formulas that are true and their weights. And this very cleanly generalizes both first-order logic and things like Bayesian networks. And, you know, and we and others have done a lot of, in both academia and industry, have done a lot of, you know, great applications with this. But so now what are the problems? Well, first, you know, the unification is not yet complete. There are still, you know, a lot of questions about how far you can take it. And then there's the big question, right, going back to the expressiveness tractability trade-off, of how can you come up with efficient inference algorithms for this, right? You have your Markov logic network, and I ask you a question, and now, you know, you need to return an answer in, you know, less than the age of the universe, preferably. So how do you do that, right? So, you know, we have something that is very expressive, but now the challenge is how to make it tractable. And one of the things that we've been working on recently is tractable subsets of things like Markov logic networks. In parallel with what people did in sort of like classic AI in the past and still do now of coming up with tractable subsets of first-order logic, except that now we also handle uncertainty as Bayesian networks do. And then, of course, there's the question of coming up with good learning algorithms for this representation, right? The representation is very powerful, potentially powerful enough for, you know, all the things that we want to do in AI and to be the foundation of a universal learner. But what should that learner do, right? Again, it's this question of what, I have all this data, I have this very powerful representation, but just doing, you know, sort of like maybe a very myopic, greedy search is probably not going to get me there in terms of constructing, you know, the formulas that, you know, represent what's true in the world. So what else can we do? And, you know, this to me is maybe the single biggest and most important question.
Absolutely fascinating. Now, again, perhaps in a broader sense, what are the big questions in deep learning?
Yeah, so we already touched on one of them, right? So the central question in deep learning is how can you discover a representation of the world in the internal layers of your network? Like, so for example, a typical application of deep learning is vision. And what, you know, the goal of deep learning is to say, I want to learn from the raw pixels. I want the learner itself to figure out, you know, where there are edges and where there are corners and where there's the tip of the nose and the face and the head and the, you know, and the whole human being and the scene that they're in, right? And this is a great problem, but, you know, it's still far from solved. One of the problems, you know, so what is preventing this from happening? One of them is the optimization, right? Is that deep learning is typically then using things like gradient descent, and gradient descent gets stuck in all these local optima. And as a result, even though maybe the network in principle could learn a very good model, in reality, it often gets stuck in a very bad local optimum. So this is really one of the key problems. Another problem is scaling up, right? You want to take advantage of a lot of data, and you have to be able to, all these things have to run fast enough that, you know, that you can stream the data through and basically, you know, learn your model as the data streams through. Another thing that people in deep learning these days are looking at a lot is moving beyond sort of like the original applications in vision and speech to things like language and reasoning. So now the question is, how do you incorporate more of these symbolic types of learning and inference into a deep learning network? Because, you know, again, if you believe in modeling the brain, you know that the brain understands language and the brain can reason and plan, but today's, you know, deep networks can't do that yet. So one of the frontiers is how do you make them do that?
You know, we've already sort of talked about some of the applications of this. Can you maybe further elaborate on, you know, let's say business and government, media, education, society?
Yeah, so, you know, deep learning folks and machine learning folks in general are very ambitious, right? I don't think they ever see a problem that they look at that they don't think they can apply machine learning to. And you know, definitely I think... What you're already seeing, right, and you're going to see more in the future is businesses where there's learning in every nook and cranny of the business. When you look at companies like Google and Amazon, this is already the case. You know, for example, Amazon is very well known for doing, you know, machine learning, you know, to recommend products to you. But another huge application of machine learning at Amazon is demand forecasting, right? They want to figure out how much of each thing people are going to order so that they can, they can stock up on it. Or order it from the, you know, from the manufacturers and so forth. But even beyond that, right, they use machine learning to optimize, you know, the workload distribution in their data centers, in the cloud computing. They use their robots, right, they have robots, you know, running around their warehouses, you know, taking things to the people who are going to pack them. Those robots use machine learning. So use machine learning pretty much everywhere. And, you know, what is true of business is also true of government, is also true of healthcare, is also true of education.
Now, we're going to go to some very general questions. Can you describe some of your most significant and influential research achievements and the practical outcomes as seen today and forecasted into the future? I know you touched on some of them, but are there others you wish to sort of outline?
So, some of the main things that I've worked on are this problem of unifying logic and probability, you know, as a step towards a developing universal learner. Another one has been, you know, scaling up machine learning algorithms to very large, you know, to big data, if you will, not just to large databases, but to data streams. Another one is this whole area of you know, modeling networks, you know, so one application of that is modeling word of mouth, but there's many others, right? You want to understand people as members of a social network, not just in isolation, and there's other networks, you know, not just social networks. Like the internet is a network, the web is a network. You know, there's networks of telecommunications networks, power networks, ecosystems are networks. So, you know, a lot of my work and a lot of the applications have been in sort of like these different types of networks. And you know, as I mentioned, one of the main things that I'm working on these days is tractable subsets of Markov logic networks. Something that I have been working a lot on that I didn't mention yet is we have our own approach to deep learning in my group and others. It's called sum product networks. It has the same characteristics as other deep learning systems in that it has many internal layers where you can develop your own representation of the world, but it has a very important characteristic, which is that the inference is always tractable. The problem in a lot of deep networks is that the inference is very intractable, which in turn makes the learning very hard because inference happens as a subroutine of the learning. In some product networks, the inference is always tractable, so you know, it's basically just one pass through the network gives you the answer, and then as a result of that, the learning also becomes a lot easier. And you know, and I also do a lot. So the work that I do is sort of like a mix of foundations theory with, you know, algorithmic development coming up with new learning and inference algorithms, with applications in a breadth of areas, including vision, language, biology, the web, and so forth.
You know, I've been sort of thinking about sort of similar questions, so maybe I'll summarize some of them. You've done so much work, so much research. They have lasting impact. You've picked up many sort of valuable lessons. There's broad applications and implications of your work throughout every domain out there. And it's interesting, when you talk to a lot of these major vendors, they talk about your work and how it sort of is the basis for what they do internally. And you've also come across many difficult challenges as you're doing your work. And is there any way that you can sort of summarize maybe some of the lessons that you've learned in doing this research? Maybe that'll help other researchers that are out there.
Yeah, sure. One lesson that I've learned is to, I think your job is, I think when you do research, you should always, swing for the fences. Go for the most ambitious thing you can do. Because incremental research is better than an industry, right? And it will also probably also work better there. People have a product, they are continuously improving it. If you are sort of like an academic researcher like me, what you want to do is you want to go for the game changers. You want, if you can, start a whole new direction or start a whole new way of doing things. And you should not be afraid to fail. You will fail most of the time, but there's nothing wrong with that, right? A lot of what I always try to tell my new graduate students is, embrace the uncertainty. Realize that, research is a search, as the name implies. Most of the places where you look for the treasure, you will find nothing. But that doesn't matter, because eventually you will find the treasure, because in research, there isn't just one treasure buried in one place. There's treasures buried all over the place. So, be ambitious. Don't be afraid to do something that seems, too far-reaching. Because often you'll be surprised, many times you'll fail, but also many times you will find that, this actually is feasible, and then you can make a lot of progress.
It's kind of interesting when you sort of swing for the fences and you have these little incremental steps, and then all of a sudden you've met the fence. It kind of reminds me of Riddus in a way.
Yeah. Well, exactly, and here's another, I think, lesson that I've learned, of which, this is an example, and in fact, a lot of the other things that we talked about also examples is, computer science at the end of the day is an applied field, so even if you do fundamental research, one of the things that you want to do, and I really try to do that, is you want to always be talking with people from all sorts of different areas, from industry, from biology, from government, from different sectors of industry, not just, the computer industry, but others. And you always want to be looking at, and you want to hear what are the problems that they have, right? What is holding them back? And then what you want to do is you want to take a step back and see what are the problems that they all have in common, or that many of them have in common. Because then you know that they can't be working on those problems, but because probably they don't even see what the solution might be, and second, they have much shorter-term concerns. But you can take a step back and say, like, aha, if I solve this problem, I'm actually solving 50 different problems at once. And then when you solve it, you actually have 50 times more impact. So in some ways, doing high-impact research is not that hard, provided you do the right things. And, and Ardis is an example of this, right? We just noticed in one problem after another that this non-convex optimization problems, these continuous problems with a lot of local optimum, with very large numbers of variables, are what's really holding up progress in a lot of different areas, including deep learning, as I mentioned, but also including things like, protein folding and drug design and whatnot. So this must be a great problem to work on, because if we can solve it, it will help a lot of different people.
Pedro, you've received a lot of recognition because, in essence, you're a pioneer, an icon, a legend globally because of the nature of your work. Your book is now going to make you cross-domain recognized throughout the world because it's consumable. From all of these awards and recognitions, do you have anything to share from a lesson standpoint?
Yeah, I think, perhaps the message that I have to share is a little unexpected, but it's the following, you know, when you do your work, when you do your research, you actually shouldn't think about winning awards, right? You should just think about doing the best that you can. And if you do the best that you can, and if you're ambitious, as I was mentioning before, if you swing for the fences, if you look for what are the big problems that everybody has, then you will wind up winning awards almost as a side effect of having done that. If you do a lot of incremental research, you know, you might have a more peaceful life, but, you know, that's not going to make the big progress happen, and then you will also not win any of these awards. If you repeatedly try to always be on the frontier, you know, really pushing things forward, really try to do risk that will have an impact, then, you know, with your ingenuity and with your hard work, you know, these things will happen.
A significant piece of our audience are also youth. So if you were to advise them, again, you are this pioneer, this icon, what are the greater burning challenges and research problems that they should look at to inspire them to go into computing?
Yeah, so, you know, I already mentioned some of them, right? I think, you know, I myself, you know, work in AI and machine learning and data science, and, you know, and there's a whole bunch of problems there. But there are also a lot of fascinating problems in other areas of computer science, right? And I think that one of the best things that sort of like a new person coming into the field can do is have a fresh perspective, right? And then, again, as I mentioned, this is one of the reasons why I wrote the book, is that I would like, you know, to help that happen. And I think what you want to do when you come into a field like computing is, first of all, you want to understand what the problems are, but you should also bring your own motivations. What are your problems that you have or that you see that you would like to see solved, but that people aren't working on yet? A lot of the biggest advances, you know, come from that. It's somebody applying to computer science, you know, or machine learning, or, you know, some other field of computer science or some combination of them, to a field that it hasn't been applied before, and then a revolution happens. And I think there's a lot more of those things waiting to happen, so you should be on the lookout for them. The other great thing that you can do as a new person coming into computing is bridge areas, right? A lot of the problem in research fields like computer science, and perhaps even more in fields that are older, is that people are already very narrowly divided into their specialties, right? You know a lot about very little. But you know, if you're young and you're a new person coming into the field, you can bridge fields. And that's another way that in some ways it's remarkably easy to have high-impact research, is to bring ideas from two different fields together. Like, for example, we did with logic and probability, and, you know, and like, for example, you know, Larry Page and Sergey Brin did, right? PageRank was the result of bringing ideas from bibliometrics, you know, like looking at where citations point, into the web. So if you have a foot in more than one area, you can often see connections and solutions that people who are entirely within one of those areas can see.
You know, that's fascinating. I just saw a research study just come out indicating that the biggest predictor of career success is people who engage in open networks. Open networks being experiencing and realizing as many diverse ideas and diverse groups and interacting with them as much as possible. And that's the single greatest predictor of success.
Yeah, I totally believe that. You know, I think you should cast a wide net. At the same time, right, it's also, on the other hand, if all that you do is cast a wide net, you might get too dispersed. So the other side of this is that you also, I think you also want to have some problem that you deeply care about. And then, what, you know, like, for example, in my case, it's the problem of, you know, coming up with this universal learner. But, you know, it can be whatever problem, you know, you're interested in, but you want to network very broadly, but then you're always looking at how do all these different people, how does their knowledge, how can it contribute to solving this problem? And that gives you a focus.
Ah, geez, it's just amazing. You know, you talked about, I think the advice you're giving is just a single very great advice, and it reminds me of a piece of research that came out of Harvard and Brigham Young about five qualities that make up for disruptive innovation. That is asking lots of questions, always questioning. The other thing is observing what's around you, and together with that, asking questions, experimenting, trying, always not being afraid of failure, associating, that is taking desperate, separate, seemingly unrelated pieces of information, integrating them in some way by associating, and then forming relationships or networking with others as well. So, and I see all of the advice you're telling, it integrates or very much aligns with this research.
Yeah, those are all great. And in fact, on the subject of asking questions, let me, you know, let's say one more thing. What you want to do is learn as much as you can. Learn everything you can, but at the same time, you shouldn't believe any of it. This is also like a difficult combination of things to do, right? Because if you don't learn everything there is to know, you know, you have no hope, right? You're just going to repeat other people's mistakes and, you know, reinvent the wheel and make it square, so you're not going to get anywhere. On the other hand, you know, the problem with a lot of experts, right, in which I include myself, is that you know a lot of stuff and you believe all of it, and that kind of narrows what you can do because you're kind of stuck in those tracks. So in a way, what you want to do as a researcher, because your role as a researcher is to make some of that knowledge obsolete, right, is to come up with things that are better or show that some of it was wrong. So you want to learn everything that you can, but then you want to take it as sort of like a salad bar of things that you can pick up or not. So you should be very willing to learn, but at the same time, you should be very skeptical. And I think these two things in a way are contradictory, but they're really essential to being able to be, you know, an innovator.
Again, such great advice. And in fact, I have a keynote coming up at the World Computing Congress where I'm talking about innovation and ways. I'm going to quote you. There's some really great nuggets here. So now, Pedro, some past, present, and future, can you name maybe some, one or more, who have inspired you or perhaps continue to do so?
Yeah, well, we actually already touched on some of them. Like, you know, Huda Perl, I think, is a great inspiration. When he started doing, you know, what he was doing in AI, nobody believed in it. And then it just swept the field. And, you know, he's someone who's both extremely he's actually the perfect embodiment of all these qualities that I was talking about. You know, extremely knowledgeable, extremely idealistic in some ways, but also sort of like kind of skeptical, you know, someone who's not easily fooled. You know, Tom Mitchell is another great machine learning researcher. You know, Jeff Hinton, again, Jeff Hinton has been... He started out as a psychologist, right? These days he's more of a computer scientist. But, you know, back from the 70s when he did his PhD, his goal was always to understand how the brain works. And he's still pursuing that goal, I think, more single-mindedly than anybody else. You know, failing a lot of the time, as he himself says, but often, you know, every now and then having huge successes that go on to change the world. And so I think it's, you know, people like this that I think inspire us.
Associate for Computer Machinery, how has its resources supported your research, and which assets are the most valuable to you?
Well, ACM, you know, supports my research every day, right? So first of all, I'm a member of CKDD, right, the ACM special interest group that deals with data science. And, you know, and you know, there's the conferences that CKDD organizes that are the leading, you know, there's hundreds of data science conferences, but the number one is undoubtedly CKDD, so that's, you know, an extremely important thing. There's also the CKDD newsletter, for example, which provides a lot of very nice, less formal, you know, information about what's happening in the field. There, you know, the publications are probably the single biggest thing that ACM does, right? So many of the papers that I read and build on, you know, came from ACM conferences, not just CKDD, but, you know, Sigma, you name it.
You know, when I hear
and CACM, right, I'd read the communications of the ACM, you know, every month. It's really, you know, reading the communications of the ACM is, you know, is how I keep up with what's happening in computer science outside of AI. So, yeah, and then there's the whole networking aspect of things. So, yeah, ACM is absolutely crucial to what I do.
Yeah, and I guess embodies, like you said, being exposed to diverse areas, and that helps infuse your research and your network of other researchers as well. You know, this is just such a fascinating interview, probably one of the most fascinating I've ever done, and I've been doing this since the 1980s, because you're just so eclectic in your thinking. So I'm really curious, what surprises you?
I'm continuously being surprised, actually. And I think, again, if you want to be a researcher or an innovator, you know, never losing the ability to be surprised is very important. You know, but the things that surprise me might surprise you. one of the things that I'm continuously surprised are things in everyday life, right? I think when you're an AI researcher, you have this amazing respect for the brilliance of the human intellect. A lot of psychologists, you know, for example, you know, Danny Kahneman, have done amazing work showing, you know, how we make mistakes and how dumb we can be. And that may all be true, but those mistakes are really the flip side of all the heuristics that we use to do things in the real world. And so, you know, when I look you know, when I look at a scene, any scene, right, it's a deep mystery how I'm actually able to look at that and see the objects that are there and then figure out how to pick them up. You know, and all of these different things that human beings are able to do, right? I think they're prepared, you know, like, for example, just picking up a paper cup from a table sounds completely banal, but it's actually full of subtleties, full of interesting things that you need to understand and model if you're ever going to build, you know, a successful robot. So everyday life, you know, is full of surprises for you if your goal is to understand, you know, how intelligence works and how learning works and how to implement them on a computer.
I see. So if I ever meet you and you're looking at me curiously, you're really analyzing all my mannerisms and thinking, how can I get a machine learning AI deep learning system to mimic this in some way?
Well, hopefully not, right? But I remember a researcher at MIT saying that, you know, your eyes, right? You think of your eyes as being your input, right? You know, it's your prime input, it's vision, right? But he was fascinated by your eyes as an output, right? Where you look is one of the most powerful cues that the people interacting with you have. And a computer, because it tells you what you're interested in, you know, what you're looking at, you know, gives me cues about what you're talking about, you know, whether you're making eye contact or not also gives me cues. And if a robot or a computer wants to interact with human beings in a natural way, it has to understand that eyes are not just, input, they're also output.
Fascinating. what will you do next?
Well, my next 3 months are going to be largely taken up with, you know, promoting the book, right? So there's going to be a lot of things to do, pieces to write, you know, media, talks to give and so on and so forth. And I think it's also going to be very instructive for me, right, to talk with, you know, a broader set of people than I talk with when, you know, when I'm just doing my daily research. And I'm also, continuing to do research. So I have several, I think very exciting problems that me and my students are working on, some of them related to deep learning, some of them to unifying logic and probability. So it's going to be a fun, you know, next few months and few years. And also, you know, I think in research as in a lot of other things, it pays to be opportunistic. You should always be with, you know, have your eyes open for the opportunities that come up. And if a new better thing to do appears, then, you know, then run with it.
I'm just continually amazed the way you think, just fascinating. Now, from your extensive speaking, travels, and work, because you are this icon in the industry and in academia, are there any stories you can share? Maybe something amusing, surprising, unexpected, or amazing?
Sure. Well, let's see. Well, here's one from my early days as a graduate student. This was back in the 90s, right before machine learning became known. And I remember having, a conversation with another student of my advisor where he was saying that, well, machine learning, you know, most of the problems have been solved, the progress that there is to be made has been made, and, the applications, I don't see any new, important applications for machine learning. And I was arguing with him that, no, machine learning is going to take over the world one day. Machine learning is how people are going to do everything. And so, you know, I always remember that because, you know, he was my friend, but then he dropped out of grad school. And I kept going with machine learning. And there was a point there in like 1994, 95 where, you know, in the beginning, you know, people with PhDs in machine learning were not getting particularly, you know, a lot of a job offers or anything. And then suddenly everything changed, right? And, you know, multiple companies were trying to hire people and starting up data mining groups and whatnot. And the amazing thing is that ever since then, things have never stopped growing. You know, every time I think, well, okay, so now machine learning has reached the plateau, but then something else comes along. The most recent one, of course, was sort of like the whole big data meme that started out, you know, a few years ago with the McKinsey report.
Now, can you describe the types of research being created or updated that will drive our experiences in 5 or 10 years and what this experience will be like? Can you paint a picture for our audience?
Yeah, so I think, I believe in Don Norman's idea of, you know, the invisible computer, which is the most mature technologies are the ones that you don't notice anymore, but that's, in a way, when they're having the most impact. So I think computing is going to become ever more pervasive, but also it's also going to become less visible. And in some sense, our ultimate victory will be when people no longer think about computing. These days, computing is very much in the headlines, but in a way, we will have succeeded when the headlines are about the next things that will be built on top of computers. And, you know, just as one obvious example, right, computers started out being these huge things that would, you know, take up a whole room, and then they shrunk to be an IBM mainframe, for example, and then it was a, you know, a DEC VAX mini computer, and then, you know, workstations like Sun, and then personal computers, and et cetera, and now it's your cell phone, right? So it keeps shrinking, and you also keep getting more of them. And so eventually, I think what's going to happen is that you're not even going to be aware of the computing devices that you're interacting with. It's just that, you know, you won't be holding on to that cell phone, trying to type on that small screen and, you know, see the tiny font and, you know, and dealing with the flaky reception. It's just that you're just going to feel that you live in a world where everything is intelligent. You can talk to your house. You can talk to your car. You know, things will actually happen and configure themselves, you know, to fit you without you even having to worry about it. And this, I think, is really where things are going. So computing at the same time is going to become richer, but paradoxically, it's also going to become less noticeable.
Yeah, and then driving all of this, of course, because you're always shooting for the fences, is this master algorithm.
Yeah, because the only, if computing becomes this ubiquitous, right, a lot of people also worry about that, like, oh, this is going to be a nightmare, right? Think of all the menus that you have in Word and submenus and all the features that you can't find. And now imagine that, you know, your fridge also has those features and everything has that. And there's billions of computing devices and they're all, you know, they're all quirky and they all have, you have to figure out how to deal with them. This would be a nightmare. The way this does not become a nightmare, it's because every one of those devices is continuously learning. You know, from your Nest thermostat to other things that companies like Nest are going to put in your home, things like Amazon's Echo, things like your car or you know, just some random piece of machinery. On the smallest scale to the largest scale of the whole web and the knowledge bases that companies like Google are building, the way this sort of like ubiquitous computing universe is going to work for you is because it's always learning about you, so you don't have to be explicitly making those choices. They're being made by the machine learning.
But then it also takes the guesswork out, like last year when the Bing search engine in their prediction model predicted the last 15 World Cup matches, 15 out of 15, and the Scottish referendum.
Well, you know, prediction is a very interesting, it's at the heart of machine learning, right? And some prediction problems are surprisingly easy, but also others are surprisingly hard, right? So one of the things that we have to do in machine learning is figure out where the frontier is between what we can predict and what we can't. But there are some things that are fundamentally unpredictable, and those we just have to figure out how to deal with them, even if we can't predict them perfectly.
Now, you continue to make significant historical contributions. How will your growing status contribute to your vision of the world, society, industry, academia, governments, and technology?
Well, you know, my goal is, you know, let me put it this way. Like when I was like 13 years old, I decided very naively that I was going to learn everything there was to know. Which, you know, very soon I realized that this was a completely infeasible goal. But then, you know, kind of like I settled on the next best thing, right, which is to learn as much as I can and learn the things that will make the most difference to the world, right? You know, how can you in your own brain synthesize, you know, all the knowledge that there is to be had and you know, or as much of it as you can? And what I found is that in every field there's a learning curve, right? 90% of what there is to know is really in the first 10% of your learning. And then, you know, what you spend the rest of life doing is refining those things that you found. And, you know, you need to have some field where you really go into depth, but also it's not that hard to, you know, learn enough of these other fields to then have an integrated picture of the whole. And I think, you know, one of the things that I like, you know, over the last couple decades of my life and hopefully also the next ones is, as I interact with more people and more varied people, I can get a better picture of how these things all connect. And again, being in machine learning, you know, if you can't learn everything there is to know, the next best thing to do is to, you know, to work on machine learning and develop algorithms that can help you, you know, synthesize knowledge from many different areas.
Again, amazing. Now, this is quite an open-ended question in a sense that if you choose the topic area, what do you see as the three top challenges facing us today? And do you have any proposals that how they can be solved?
Yeah, well, so, you know, many of them, of course, have to do with computing, and we've already touched on some of those. But I think there are also a lot of areas where there are, you know, really big problems that we have to deal with today, and you know, and we need to get on it, and you know, and people are getting on it, you know, and, you know, just to give you one example, right? I think one thing that's happening in the world today that is very worrisome is that we have, you know, abused our antibiotics, and there are superbugs growing that we have no antibiotics that work against them, and you know, there's also sort of like new sources of epidemics that can appear, you know, overnight, and this danger, right, is always there, and as the world becomes more connected, the danger actually goes up, because you know, disease gets propagated more quickly. So I think this is a set of problems that we very much need to focus our attention on, and you know, for example, we need things and. Perhaps not coincidentally, several of the things that we were talking about actually relate to this. So being able to, you know, come up with new antibiotics and new drugs faster by using computers for it, by doing some of the work in silico instead of, you know, in vitro is one approach. Having better networks, you know, that detect outbreaks very quickly and then, you know, quickly spread information and then, you know, the for example, the genomes of the viruses get sequenced and the corresponding, you know, you know, vaccines get developed. This is all stuff that we can do. Another example is, you know, this may not be the thing most prominent on a lot of people's minds, but it is a little problem, is things like, you know, nuclear proliferation. We've been very lucky so far that, you know, after the first two bombs in World War II, none others have been exploded, but as more and more actors get their hands on nuclear weapons and more dubious actors, you know, the chances that something bad will happen continue to increase. And again, you know, we have to be on top of this problem. And, you know, and there's many others like this. You know, you were talking about the UN's, you know, Millennium Developmental Goals, right? And, you know, I think it's both very heartening that so much progress was made on many of them, but there's also a lot still left to do.
Yeah, you know, just you kind of reminded me of this other area too, precision genetic medicine, you know, the CRISPR-Cas9 technique. It's really cheap. It allows us to, in essence, modify our history, and it's readily available. And so, you know, what's going to happen because there aren't a lot of policies around it yet?
Yeah, I mean, actually, this is a great example of how new learning and new technology creates both enormous opportunities and enormous dangers, right? The ability to manipulate the genome has, you know, almost unlimited potential to do good, right? You could prevent a lot of, you know, disease that happens today. You could create, you know, better crops, et cetera, et cetera. On the other hand, the potential for harm is also unlimited, right? People could create, you know, superbugs that will kill a lot of people. People could just, you know, be irresponsible and, you know, create, you know, who knows, monsters. So at the same time that we develop these technologies, you know, there has to be a debate involving all of society about how best to use them, what guidelines to have, what red flags to have, what directions to go in. And, you know, by the way, you know, professional societies like the ECM have a really important role to play in this, because it's how, for example, the computing community can have a say in all of these issues. In all of these issues, the experts, you know, it's very important to listen to the experts, like, for example, in the case of computing, because otherwise you're doomed. On the other hand, the final decision does not just involve the experts. It has to be made by the people, because the experts know about their field, but they can't know what's best for people or what they want.
Yeah, I guess this whole idea of unintended consequences.
Yeah.
Now we're down to our very last question, and this is again where I open it up, and I always ask, if you were conducting this interview, what questions would you have asked, and then what would be your answers?
That's a great question. I think, you know, this interview was so comprehensive that you've probably asked all the questions that I would have asked and many more besides. So, you know, I don't know if I have a good answer to that question. Hopefully my answers to the previous questions were good enough that they make up for a lack of an answer to this one.
Well, Pedro, this has been a real favorite interview of mine. As I mentioned, I've done over 1,000 notables over the since the 1980s, and just remarkable. I know you have to go. Great interview. I know just we're so fortunate to have you share so much of your wisdom and experiences with our audience. Again, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was a great pleasure.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Pedro Domingos, globally renowned, top-ranking data scientist, AI researcher, who recently led his team to the top AI prize.